when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think, I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Griffin. I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In place of democracy, very good.
I think my favourite in our updated intro montage is a certain French president saying, I don't think I know. So thanks to Democracy Sausage's brilliant executive producer, Angus Blackman, who put together that montage in spare time that he doesn't really have. Hello, and thanks to for listening to Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week, of course, from Australia's only national university and specifically from the Australian Studies Institute, the School of Politics and International Relations, and the Crawford School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Kenny. History may not repeat, but it certainly has some familiar harmonics. Europe facing a dangerous war over territory in which ethnic nationals are the technical justification for incursion. And Britain, as it was in the lead-up to World War II, really just an island unto itself again. A lot of that, of course, is down to the self-styled Churchill enthusiast, biographer even, who, like his subject, has links to America. Winston Churchill's mother, of course, was American, and Boris Johnson was born there. These are our topics this week, which is not surprising, really, given the Ukraine crisis, which is escalating even as we speak, what that means for Europe, NATO, the West, China's ambitions in this region, and how Australia is being viewed after 2+ years of forced isolation. And of course, Boris Johnson, he's embroiled in scandal, awaiting a ruling from the Metropolitan Police as to whether he broke COVID laws he wrote and enforced on the country. So there's a lot to talk about, and my guest this week is Sophia Gaston, who I'm delighted to say is actually here with me in the studio in Canberra, unlike the usual remote arrangement, Sophia, where you come to us from London.
It's great to be here, 2 years on.
Yes, and here we sit with masks on, so apologies if that leads to any sort of slightly different sound than we normally have. Let's start with sort of Boris Johnson. I know the Ukraine crisis, as I say, is escalating even as we speak. We've heard some very disturbing news really just in the last half hour that since we came together, but we'll come to that. But Boris Johnson, it's an entertaining story for those of us in Australia watching it, puzzling in so many ways. He seems to have been involved in almost a sort of a constant state of scandal. There's been the scandal over his, you know, for the funding of renovations to his flat, the pandemic arrangements, Dominic Cummings, his former staffer who turned on him, Tory MPs earning vast sums from sort of running consultancies or working as lobbyists. Of course, these parties at number 10 now, which are the subject of this Metropolitan Police investigation. He's refused to answer the question about whether he will resign if the Metropolitan Police conclude that he has, in fact, or that people at number 10 have, in fact, broken the law. Do you think he will, or is this sort of, is the heat gone out of this because of other pressing issues and just how long it's taken?
I think the heat is going out of it. And certainly there, it's absolutely the case that we did get quite close up to the brink of feeling as though he might not be long in post. And I think that was quite an extraordinary feeling in Westminster, because Boris Johnson, you know, the received wisdom is that he, you know, is incredibly resilient and has been able to sort of wriggle himself out of tight situations his entire career. It's important to note that all of this began really, you know, obviously there are roots in the fracturing of the relationship with Dominic Cummings, and Dominic Cummings, his former aide, is waging an active campaign to unseat him from office.
It's really quite extraordinary, that, isn't it? Because it's very colourful, and there's some resonances here with Scott Morrison, who we'll come to later as well, in terms of, you know, someone close to the leader giving a you know, a testimonial about, you know, an insider view of being up close with this person and giving a damning character assessment. Does it get taken seriously, or is Cummings seen as the eccentric character that he is, and is it sort of dismissed on that basis?
I think Cummings is, you know, because of his proximity to the Prime Minister and his very central role in Number 10 in the time that he was there, I think all the new information he brings to light is obviously taken seriously and you know, given light and time of day in Westminster. But equally, everything is taken with an enormous grain of salt, because his motivations are so laid bare. And, you know, he's...
And what are those motivations? Is it sort of just sort of bitterness from the way it all ended and a sense of revenge? I mean, there's obviously a lot of personal animus there now.
Absolutely. I mean, Dominic Cummings will say that he's acting on behalf of the good of the nation, that he actually is a sort of statesman who's trying to raise the alarm. He's the sort of Cassandra trying to show that Boris Johnson is ultimately dangerous and a threat to not only kind of, you know, national interests and decency and standards in public life, but that he's a sort of threat to national security. But, you know, of course, I think most people in Westminster really feel that he is motivated by a sort of pretty unedifying, you know, transfixion with revenge. He's particularly focused on the Prime Minister's wife, Carrie Johnson. And, you know, it's very difficult to not look at some of his, you know, some of the kind of ways in which he's been leaking stories and the kinds of narratives he's been trying to construct as absolutely motivated by a degree of misogyny as well.
Oh, that's interesting. That there's, you're saying this, there's a sense, there's a theory that he has some sort of underlying hatred for women. And that this is in part his motivation for his attack on the PM's wife.
Well, I think the Vote Leave campaign, which is kind of really where he came to prominence and certainly was his route into Number 10, it was a pretty blokey operation. And I think, you know, there's you know, that's been plain to see. You know, I can't assess whether or not he is a misogynist, but I think certainly most people would feel that while there are legitimate questions to raise about the role of the Prime Minister's wife, given the very unusual situation of her being a political operator herself and a very kind of senior member of the Conservative Party, and also obviously very close friends with a lot of the staff working in Number 10. You know, I think while there are legitimate questions there, there also has been an air of sexism in a lot of the commentary. And it's absolutely true that Dominic Cummings has been a driving force in leaking a lot of these stories that seem specifically focused to denigrate her, perhaps sometimes even more so than the Prime Minister.
Let's go to the actual allegation at the moment, that the allegations that the Met is looking at, which in some ways, I think you're of the view that to some extent this has given Boris Johnson some breathing space, because the Met takes some time to go through this. That in itself is kind of, you know, slightly mysterious. It's amazing that all of these political issues, when they come up, certainly in Australia and seems in the UK as well, once they go into these inquiries, whether it be police inquiries or special inquiries that are set up, they seem to take an inordinately large amount of time, and that's often to the advantage of the accused. The one that we're talking about here, you know, were there some, you know, a whole series of parties in Number 10 during a period when the rest of the country was required to completely divide and separate and stay in their homes and not associate in any way? And was Number 10, you know, doing, you know, pursuing its own set of rules? Is that the sort of long and the short of it? Is there more to this?
I think, you know, it's funny. It was striking to me that you said at the beginning that it's, you know, been very entertaining to watch from Australia because, I mean, while, of course, the Westminster machine loves sort of kicking into action when there's a scandal like this and, you know, moving into overdrive, at the core of this issue is a very painful story. You know, at that time when all of these, the investigations into these parties have been taking place, at that time in England, you know, we were living with restrictions that are utterly unprecedented and were incredibly draconian and impeded with a lot of, you know, the most core human instincts. And people were separated from, you know, loved ones who were passing away, couldn't have funerals, people living socially atomized lives. You know, a lot of these rules and regulations end up being updated and evolved pretty quickly after this time. But this was the absolute crux of it. And it was a time that a lot of people, I think, haven't really wanted to look back on very much. But certainly when they do, it's a source of great trauma for people. And we haven't really kind of nationally had that moment. And so what's happened is that with all these revelations coming out, people are sort of looking back on that time and it's almost kind of bringing all of those stories up to the fore that people had wanted to bury and move on from. So that's certainly the context in the way in which individual people and MPs alike, who of course, just their inboxes have just been flooded with individual stories about the impacts. Now, you know, there is a degree of reckoning around this because to some extent, you now look at this, you know, a lot of the Westminster conversation has been to say, well, actually, those regulations were completely inappropriate and too extreme and so on. So I think that's one side of it. But I think it's the hypocrisy. And it's not like there was a kind of Trumpian experience here where Boris Johnson would say it was, you know, against restrictions and downplaying the severity of the pandemic. While this sort of convivial, sociable culture was you know, permeating through Number 10, he was every night going out in these press conferences and telling people, these are the rules, you have to stick to them. And he was very grave about it. So I think that's what has been troubling for people. So I don't want to make light of how serious these allegations are. But I do think that so much power is in the hands of the incumbent. And it's all about momentum. And actually, there have been several other scandals and missteps and crises that had all compounded up into the point where Partygate, as it's now known, kind of came to the fore. So there was a sort of bedrock of, you know, ill feeling and discord amongst the Conservative Party, which we should note is rather less disciplined than the Conservative Party of the past. And so, you know, everything kind of was reaching a fever pitch where something that is not common in British politics did look possible. Now, I do think that a lot of that has
that
ebbed.
That being the necking of a leader, you mean?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's certainly not something that, you know, I mean, we had that every month here. Well, exactly. We had that a bit with Theresa May, but that was, I mean, really a moment of national crisis around the Brexit, kind of no deal situation with Parliament in chaos. So there is a really high threshold to get to that point. And what's happened is some of the plotters, you know, went a bit too early, overplayed their hand. Some cabinet members kind of were forced to pull back a little bit. So a lot of that kind of feeling of momentum seems to have fallen away. So I would say that the odds of him staying have increased quite significantly over the past fortnight.
And that's going to the sort of question of whether he will resign on the back of whatever the Met's findings are, and that's interesting. I suppose there's another question about, you know, which I've written in my notes here, is he toast or Teflon? I mean, he's been Teflon. He's got that sort of indefatigable optimist thing happening, and that's kind of in tune with the times. People need that, and Boris Johnson sort of personifies it, as a word you used last night when we were discussing this. In some ways, you can imagine him just battling through, But there are competitors circling now who think that, yes, he might get through this particular moment of the crisis, but he still may not be there come the time of the next election.
Yes, I think there has always been a sense, Boris has, there are some people who are incredibly loyal to him, but he doesn't have an expansive base in the party in the way that some others have, partly because he sort of came into the party in a rather unusual way. You know, he was mayor of London, he was sort of not in the cut and thrust of the kind of ministerial scramble to the top. So, you know, there have always been those. I mean, even when he came to power, there were plenty of his fellow MPs who have no love for him whatsoever. So it was always going to be in danger, even with an 80-seat majority, to these kinds of things. And I think his behaviour was always going to be watched closely. What's happened now with that fever pitch of momentum that has dissipated is that what was created in that time still exists, which is several fairly fleshed out, functional leadership campaigns of several potential candidates.
People like Liz Truss, who's currently the Foreign Secretary?
Yes, and the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak. There's several others of different sort of factions
of the
party.
Would they be the two primary ones, you would think, Truss and Sunak?
I think that their campaigns are given a certain degree of credence because they are in the cabinet at the moment. So, you know, it's a kind of, firstly, they're more visible. It's an easier springboard. But also their campaigns are more dangerous. They can only afford to move when they're absolutely certain. Yeah, there are other backbenchers and sort of senior politicians, particularly, you know, there's sort of some from the kind of fringes on both sides, including the kind of more liberal wing of the party, who can probably kind of maneuver a bit more in the shadows before they have to put their head above the parapet. But I think, you know, there's always been this sense of maybe it makes sense to keep Boris in post to manage the transition out of COVID, which is what's happening right now. And then there's these big local elections in early May. There is some concern that the Conservatives might do pretty badly in those.
There was that by-election recently where they got absolutely hammered.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so it's unclear how those elections are going to go, but they may perform badly. And if they do, I think there'll be a bit of momentum gathering again for a potential summer leadership challenge.
Because that would be like a real-world window into what the voters are thinking about Boris Johnson, whether, you know, it would sort of suggest that the gloss had completely worn through.
Indeed. I think, look, you've got a couple of competing things here. It's absolutely clear that Boris's approval ratings have, you know, fallen quite significantly over recent months, and that fall is genuine. At the same time, I do think that there is a sense in British politics, you know, the very most significant kind of paradigm that has been in place from 2019 onwards and has remained resilient during the pandemic is just, we want to move on. We want to look for the future. We want to feel good about the country. We want to be optimistic. Let's put all of this behind us and go forward. Nobody wants an acrimonious, emotional, stressful, factional kind of environment in politics. We've been through a national trauma and upheaval in some way with Brexit. And so I think there is.
And then the pandemic, of course.
Well, indeed. And then the pandemic. So I think there is a degree to which, you know, the threshold for imposing further change has to be really high. And you would have to know that the outcome on the other side is going to feel competent and like a really well-oiled machine.
Yeah. Yeah. I perfectly understood. Now, just quickly, we're going to take a break in a moment, but I'd just like to get to the visit that was to happen with Boris Johnson coming to Australia, which didn't happen. It sort of ended up being a virtual meeting. Just interesting reasoning, really, about that trip. I mean, who would it have benefited, Scott Morrison or Boris Johnson? I imagine Johnson, for all his faults and foibles, is probably quite an exotic and I would imagine a figure of some interest, perhaps even affection for many in Australia, not universally, of course, but Would that have been to Morrison's benefit or to Johnson's benefit? And perhaps it would have caused Morrison, you know, given that Johnson is so much more progressive on climate change, might have caused Morrison a bit of anguish, really, leading into the election with journalists constantly questioning him about Britain's superior position on climate change.
For sure. And, you know, I think given, on one hand, you've got the AUKUS partnership, which in a way kind of creates a meaningful pretext for a lot more of these kind of bilateral visits in any case. But I think given we had just had Aukerman with the Foreign Secretary and Defence Secretary out from the UK.
This is the Australia-UK Foreign Ministers.
Exactly. Mm. It did feel perhaps as though it was a little bit more of a politically oriented visit about kind of, you know, shoring up that leader-to-leader relationship. Mm. And, you know, I think you've outlined very well some of the risks here. I think it's a very finely tuned calculation on both sides. And at some point, I think the risks possibly on both sides just flipped a little bit. And so, you know, the potential rewards for Boris Johnson, you know, perhaps were less clear, and the potential rewards for Scott Morrison were less clear. And I think in that environment, there was a bit of a push to pull back. And you know, I understand that visit is sort of still on the cards in some kind of way, but it will probably be taking place after the election now.
Yes, yeah, so it could be with Scott Morrison. It may well be with Anthony Albanese.
Indeed.
We'll see what happens. Let's just take a quick break there and be back in a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, I'm joined here, of course, by Sophia Gaston, who's the director of the British Foreign Policy Group. I should have said that at the top of the show, but you've no doubt heard her before. She's obviously very well dialed in with all kinds of matters in Westminster and the foreign policy establishment in Britain and its relationship with the UK and the rest with Europe and the rest of the world. Let's go to this Ukraine crisis now, because this is very important. You know, this is not your average story here. This is really the first serious war in Europe since the Second World War. And there are some parallels here as well. I mean, you know, parallels with the Second World War are often perilous things. But nonetheless, we have, as I said at the start, you know, these aggressive moves pursued under the pretext of protecting ethnic citizens. You know, Hitler argued this. Putin's arguing this now. What's the latest as we sit here?
Well, I should say, you know, I think it's natural in a way for people in Australia to be feeling this is happening on the other side of the world. How seriously should I be paying attention to this? You know, I very much want to emphasize that what's happening here, this crisis with Russia invading Ukraine again, you know, this is something that has the direct interests of the Western alliance and our, you know, Western partners and allies at stake. And so it's something that absolutely I think Australia should be very much focused on. Obviously, I understand the geographical pivot, but these are about, you know, this issue here is really about the future of liberal democracy and the advance of authoritarian powers and a kind of lawlessness and a recklessness about international law and treaties and conventions that have played a really important role in underpinning global peace and security. And that has all sorts of ramifications that would absolutely hit home here in the Indo-Pacific as well.
And that's a really – and what you're saying there is this is a really pivotal moment where all of that comes up for test, really, that is being sorely tested now. So we're seeing it happen in real time. You've been in the country now for about a week. Have you noticed a difference in the way this crisis has been reported, from the Northern Hemisphere to here?
Well, I mean, obviously in the UK, it's been really, you know, obviously the kind of domestic political Partygate scandals aside, it has been the big story for really around a month or more. And that's partly because Russia is very firmly established as the fundamental security paradigm in the UK. It's partly because the UK has been playing a really leading proactive role in supporting Ukraine and coordinating an international response effort. And it's also partly because, you know, this in some ways is about the NATO alliance. And in the UK, you know, we definitely see ourselves as the leading European power in that. So I think, you know, for all of those reasons, the UK has played a big role. It's been front and center. I think, you know, it's not so much here that I've picked up a sort of difference in the way in which it's being reported. It's more just the sort of attention that's been given to the crisis full right. stop. And I think there is obviously a tendency here to try and connect the questions about Russia into the questions about China. And to that point, I think there was a meeting, a very significant meeting between Presidents Xi and Putin during the Olympics very recently. And what was very unusual about that meeting is it was entirely focused on international relations. So it was a kind of global purview in the way that we don't normally see between these two leaders. It's almost their kind of version of a G7 statement. And there were some pretty alarming things in there because there was a lot of conceptual synchronicity, but there are also some quite significant practical steps that came out of that, including a sort of long anticipated deal around gas traveling from Russia into China, which of course could offset any potential disruption to European markets as well. But what's happened more recently?
So just to pick you up on that. So yeah. That is China essentially agreeing to buy gas that yep. would be cut off from supply to Europe.
So that actually increases, this is China essentially underpinning
stepping in, yeah.
the resilience of Russia's gas markets, which in some ways reduces a little bit the power that the West has to sort of threaten to withdraw from those markets and things like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, for example. But what has happened in the past few days, and this is really centered around the Munich Security Conference, which is the big conference where all world leaders get together and talk about kind of global peace and security. And obviously the whole focus of this conference was really about Ukraine. The very interesting thing was we've started to see China rolling back a little bit from the kind of tenor of that discussion around international relations, making very clear that they actually oppose territorial incursions being made by Russia into Ukraine and that they defend Ukraine's sovereignty.
That this is really quite significant, isn't it?
It's extremely significant. And the calculation there is that China has realized that their whole predication of their kind of national interest in Hong Kong and also in Taiwan is around China's sovereignty, with those territories and being an island being, you know, a part of their sovereign territory. Mm. And in supporting Russia to come in and try and create politically independent separatist territories, they could in fact be actually bolstering the argument for independence in places like Taiwan. So that's been really important. And I do think to some degree shows some of the limitations of that Russia-China partnership.
Yes, and it's interesting because Scott Morrison's been saying in Parliament really ratcheting up the pressure on Xi Jinping to condemn Vladimir Putin's ambitions and so forth. And there's been a lot of commentary about that initial meeting that happened during the Olympics. It's never been completely clear to me that China was particularly interested in that it was consistent with what we understand about China for China to want the chaos to ensue that might come from Putin moving in Ukraine, and perhaps that he's playing a slightly more nuanced role than he was being given credit for. That is, maintaining a high level of trust in the relationship between he and Putin so as to be able to achieve some sort of diplomatic end. I mean, that is diplomacy in a way, and maybe there's more to what China's doing than has been on the surface.
Well, I think, you know,
very hopeful.
Yes. I mean, look, in a way, if you even look at the West, I mean, you know, we have come much more closely together over recent weeks, which has been very important on the crisis at the border in Ukraine. You know, we've started to be much more aligned on sanctions and sort of the assessment of the threat and the possible responses and the sort of optimism around diplomacy. But equally, you know, even in the West, we're rather divided around our approaches to responding to this crisis and particularly, you know, the extent to which these sanctions should touch on different sorts of instruments, whether they're, you know, energy or financial instruments, investments and so on. So in that sense, you know, there's a bit of nuance there. And I think we should also assume that China is playing its kind of longer term and shorter term interests off against one another with Russia. And so there's more nuance in that relationship. I do think it is really worth us reading those statements that came out of that meeting very carefully, because both Russia and China have been fairly consistent at showing us their intent. China in particular tends to have quite long-term plans. They're in some ways very transparent about what they're trying to do, and we haven't always looked very closely at them. So I think we need to be realistic that the threat, the idea of these powers working together in a kind of really coordinated, close alliance in the same way that we understand alliances in the West, I just don't think is credible at this stage.
Mm. But it's a bit too simplistic, yes. But it suits certain political narratives,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
That's certainly the narrative in Australia from the government, that China will welcome the chaos and the focus of the West on the Ukraine crisis to pursue its own ambitions, as you say, with Hong Kong and Taiwan in particular.
I mean, I think that China will be watching.
I guess that remains possible, doesn't it?
Well, look, China will be watching closely, but they to some degree do favour consistency and stability where they feel it serves their interests. I don't think that, you know, that there's fundamentally different philosophies guiding not only their geopolitical interests, but the compact that they have between citizens and state. And I think it's always really important to come back to that. For China, the relationship, the kind of political settlement is very much built around an idea of economic growth and prosperity. And so that's always going to be the number one driving force. And so instability in global markets, disruptions to supply chains and so on, those sorts of things are not necessarily going to be viewed favorably in China. And I don't think that we can see, you know, China has absolutely been escalating its aggressions in the Indo-Pacific and, you know, in places like Hong Kong, you know, that there is a sort of violence and menace to that. We shouldn't gloss over that. But Russia is a fundamentally different actor. And it's, while China has become more risk tolerant, Russia's risk tolerance feels at a pretty unprecedented point in recent history. And I do think there are questions about, you know, if Putin's just given a speech a couple of hours ago where he set out his kind of pretext for this new invasion. And, you know, that
he's
did
declared
seem,
a couple of republics, hasn't he?
Yes. And, you know, the sort of nature of that speech felt quite sort of maniacal and a little bit unhinged, even for him. Mm. And there are questions, we are hearing a little few whispers about, you know, the question as to how deep the support he actually has behind him on this. So, you know, within the Kremlin. So that could be seen as he's actually taking on a lot more personal risk as well with this situation.
It's really fascinating because one dimension of this has to be the economic. We know there's all these sanctions that the UK, Liz Truss has announced the UK sanctions will commence immediately, literally just in the sort of
yes.
hour before we started having this conversation as a result of those republics being declared and Putin setting up that pretext and tanks moving in. Events are happening fast, and probably when people are listening to this, there may be even more concrete and worrying developments. But the Russian economy is is not as big as it used to be or as people might think. In fact, it's smaller than Australia's economy. I think Australia's at 13 and Russia's at 14 or 15 in the scale of global economies. So, yes, it's a nuclear power. Yes, it's a former superpower, during the Cold War and in the post-World War II settlement. What's its ability to – I mean, because what made me think of this was your point about whether there's a kind of a uniform support for this within the Russian military, within the Russian government, such as it is. I wonder how long Russia can sustain. The cost of this must be huge, and that's not even taking into account the foregone growth and wealth that can come from otherwise trading without those sanctions.
Yes. I mean, look, the cost of staging this and building up nearly 200,000 troops on the border and all of the kind of other defensive materials and
military, you know, hospitals and,
exactly,
and the armaments and so forth.
You know, plus, you know, let's not forget there are already sanctions leveled at Russia for various transgressions over the past decade. The economic costs are significant. So what's the driving factor here? This is not about, you know, shoring up the country's economic security or its economic future. In fact, he's actually going to make life a lot more difficult for the Russian people over the long term. And I think it's very important that we do emphasize, you know, when we talk about Russia, that we're talking about the Russian regime and Putin's regime in particular, and not the Russian people themselves, who in many ways will also be victims of this decision.
I guess that would be, it may be an unlikely outcome, but that would be the best outcome from this, really, would be for common sense to prevail and for Putin to be removed by his own people.
Well, it's one of the reasons why Putin is moving now, because he's seizing an opportunity. That's really what's happening here. He feels there's sort of two aspects to this. I think, firstly, he feels that the window of sort of coercing Ukraine into becoming a failed state is relatively narrow, in part because the younger generations have been persuaded of the value and their interests in pursuing a more kind of open, liberal European future. Mm-hmm. And Ukraine could just be one sort of leader away from, you know, getting its act together and cleaning up some of the corruption and being able to kind of more economically, you know, flourish. The other thing is, of course, the instability in the West, and there's a lot of different components of that. Putin has always watched Western domestic politics relatively closely because he understands that those weaknesses, whether it's socially or politically, constrain and shape their behavior on the world stage. And he's very aware that there are, you know, some pretty kind of fraught calculations having to be made there. He watched the chaotic, shameful scenes in the withdrawal of Afghanistan. He sees Angela Merkel stepping down. He sees Biden about to be pulled into the fray around the midterm elections and already struggling to get legislation through Congress. So, you know, and France is in elections. The UK is working out its role after Brexit. So,
and he knows after Iraq and Afghanistan that the West has no, the American public, for example, has no appetite for any sort of ground wars anyway.
Yeah, there's no public consent for military intervention in a kind of proactive way, right? And he's aware of all of that. So for him, the stakes of the window of opportunity with Ukraine, you know, and that is his long-term goal, to have Ukraine declared a failed state in which he can kind of, you know, step in with a, you know, under a sort of form of kind of like both economic and political coercion, you know, that window is closing. And also the window of opportunity in terms of the West being distracted, insular, consumed by other things, and perhaps not getting along as well, as, you know, may also be short-lived. So that's why he's acting now. And there's no kind of, you know, he's not going to derive any direct economic benefits. This is a geopolitical strategic choice in which, in many ways, what he's pursuing, a lot of that can be gained before he even had to step you know, have a boot go across the border. A lot of this was about emphasizing chaos and division in the West, you know, and the implications of that. And I have to say, you know, things were a bit dicey there a few weeks ago, but we are sort of generally pulling together in the right way, in the right direction. The implication of another chaotic, divided, on the back foot kind of response here to Ukraine after Afghanistan would have had real lasting damage, not just, you know, domestically within Western nations, but it would have impeded the way in which people think about alliances and the importance of those alliances. And also, let's not forget, we have plenty of partners around the world who are dependent in various ways on strategic and defensive and security support from the West. And they're watching all of this and starting to wonder, well, can we really rely on those guarantees, and do we need to look elsewhere? So, you know, yes, this is Ukraine. It's not a NATO member now, but this the implications and the stakes, not just for Europe, but for the West, it and all of its, you know, constituent members, are very high.
Sophie Gaston, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. You're so well informed and well connected into all of these debates, and really, really fascinating to hear your thoughts on this desperate situation that's unfolding and changing and deteriorating even as we speak. So our hearts go out to the people of Ukraine in particular, and to any innocent people caught up in this. And we just hope that there is not the worst case scenario, and some sort of a better path can be found. Thanks for being here, and it's been terrific to have you in the studio in Australia, and we'll look forward to talking to you again. It'll probably be more remote next time, but once again, thanks, Sophia, for coming on Democracy Sausage.
Thanks very much for having me.
And that's the program for this week. I'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.